This year I'm lecturing at all three National Sea of Faith conferences for the first time, so I put all three lectures into a single document. I noticed there was a sort of common theme. Each conference gave me a title to write to, but the theme of religion and culture was common to all three. To introduce what I'm saying and make it clearer, let me tell a little story about visiting Denmark for the first time in my life, about a year ago. I was very struck there, in the middle of Aarhus it was, by the splendour with which the Lutheran churches were restored and preserved, and by the tenacity and determination with which the theologians defended Lutheranism and the establishment of the Lutheran Church in Denmark, where, of course, it still attracts a lot of taxation and spends a lot of public welfare money. And it became clear to me that the people who defended a very conservative version of Lutheranism and the establishment of it in their country were not, in fact, practicing Christians. They believed in their own Scandinavian cultural tradition, of which the Lutheran churches are in each country a major part. This was an example of how in the modern world religion tends to get conscripted into becoming part of a cultural tradition that people see as threatened and fight to defend. And when religion is conscripted into this role, it comes to be called part of your identity and is something you can serve in a very, very conservative form. Religion becomes something to fight for, something to mummify and keep as heritage, a sort of token or symbol of national identity. Religion gets turned into almost the spiritual arm of nationalism. And that's my feeling of doubt about this is aroused in me when I hear appeals to multiculturalism and people talking of a vision of society as consisting of a large number of people who come from distinct cultural traditions, all of them fighting for the integrity and the continuance unchanged of their own cultural tradition. I want to rebel sharply against that, and that's why the theme of my contribution to this course is a bit distinct from what David Patterson no doubt had in mind when he first suggested this particular topic. Rather than encourage people to stay rooted in their own difference from each other, I argue for globalization and for cultural mixing, for the melting pot. If you like, I prefer the original American approach to naturalization, where everybody becomes an American. Of course, the continuation of your own language and national tradition is permitted indeed, but there's also a duty to acknowledge the wider society of which you're part. So that's why I'm talking about learning to live without identity, because, as I'm going to make clear, we English have ourselves experienced globalization in our own country, especially perhaps since the late 50s, when the language of popular cinema and music, the kids' pop music, became American, and we lost, and particularly amongst the people in general, our own national tradition. Another example of the same phenomenon is the fact that my own books have to be translated into English before they can be published in America. And I realise this is what it means to find yourself decentred. We're no longer in charge of our own language, no longer even considered as having sort of any proprietary rights in it or as having invented it. We have to conform to alien standards. We're part of a wider cultural whole. Well, anyway, here's my text. In our tradition, we have, for many centuries, tended to alternate between two styles of thinking that I shall call globalism and localism. The globalist outlook wants to see a single set of universal laws of reason, laws of nature, and moral principles prevailing throughout the whole world. But in reaction against it, localist thinking emphasizes local differences, and tells us to identify with our own cultural tradition, our own distinctive vision of the world, our faith and our customs. Above all, we should seek out and cling to everything that differentiates us from the rest of humanity and binds us together. Difference is seen as being more important and valuable than sameness. The contrast I'm describing here is familiar in the Hebrew Bible. The globalist or universalist strain, found in some of the latter prophets and the writings, presents a religious vision that reaches out to the whole of humanity, whereas the localist strain concentrates exclusively upon the election by God of the people of Israel, their special task and destiny. At its most globalist, for example in the later chapters of Isaiah or in the book of Proverbs or Job, at its most globalist, the Hebrew Bible speaks of Adam and is a book for all humanity. At its most localist, the Hebrew Bible is extremely ethnocentric, laying down all the ritual observances by which the Jews insist upon their difference from all other peoples, and saying to them that your own people's special relationship to your God, whom you know by his own name, is a fundamental fact about you which must rule your whole life. For you, Jewishness comes first in every way, and humanity in general comes a rather poor second. In the more recent Western tradition, the great triumph of Isaac Newton's physics made globalism prevail across the Western world for over a century. Newton had proved that a universal mathematical physics was possible. He had shown that all local motion everywhere in the universe is governed by a small set of simple and clear mathematical rules. Nature was an elegant and predictable machine, the same everywhere, and it seemed that the whole scheme of things within which human beings lived was well designed and good. There were universal laws of reason and of nature, and it seemed obvious that our human codes of law and morals should follow the same pattern and be the same everywhere. People began to speak about international law and to draw up declarations of universal rights of man. Globalism peaked, one might say, in the language of the American and French revolutions and in the work of the Jewish scholar Moses Maimonides, 1729 to 1788, in whose day leading Jews even contemplated giving up their separate Jewish identity and becoming completely assimilated into Protestant Christianity. That is something we could hardly imagine today. For of course, during the 19th century, there was a sharp localist reaction in the rise of messianic nationalism, not only amongst the Jews themselves, but in many countries, certainly in all European countries. Your nation had its own distinctive language, history, culture, and art tradition, and you must be prepared to sacrifice your life for the sake of its honour, its independence, and its sovereignty. In fact, nationalism and the cult of the national spirit became an immensely powerful secular religion. Ethnocentrism was a sacred duty. Notice how every European country developed its own national art tradition. The National Gallery, till very recently, was divided up into national schools. Remember, in London, art historians wrote the history of art in terms of national schools, and composers wrote music that was deliberately designed to portray the national spirit. Everyone can think of a composer of almost every European country who produced a work of music that captures the national spirit and folk tradition of that country. Extreme nationalism divides the whole world up into competing nations, each of which thinks only of its own interest. In time, it provokes a reaction as internationally minded people try to check national egoism and develop international laws, conventions, and institutions. And that's roughly where we are today. This political history, by the way, let me sum up the political history. Over the last 20 years, we've seen about 20 more European countries coming into being. The latest is Montenegro, perhaps the next will be Barcelona. So at the very same time as the Union of Europe has been roaring ahead and the common market has expanded to 26 nations or whatever it is now, Europe has been breaking up into more and more distinct sovereign countries as well. That's both globalism and localism operating at once. This political history has been reflected in the history of religions. The scholars of the Enlightenment were the first to construct a list of major world religions, each with its own great territory, its language, its culture, its history, its doctrine and rituals. Thus, as the modern nation-state was being invented, so the modern conception of a religion as a kind of spiritual nation was being invented. People found themselves committed by birth to sacred territories, Christendom, Islam, Hindustan, or the Buddhist world, or to what was usually called fetishism or animism. Language, culture, religion, homeland, these things were part of your birthright. They were all clubbed together and all to be defended. This was a fateful development because in due course it made people around the world aware of their own distinctive religion as their own heritage. One had a duty to know about it and take a pride in it. So that as in politics the concept of my nation was the seedbed of militant nationalism, so people began to get militant and assertive about their own distinctive religious heritage. A famous illustration of all this, by the way, is the fact that Gandhi grew up in India despising his own national religious tradition. He only learned to admire Hinduism, and he learnt about Hinduism as a young student in London. He took back his political movement to India, and the revival of nationalist Hinduism has now gone so far as to produce the modern BJP type Hindu nationalist politics. A very far cry in values from Gandhi, but a neat example of the way ideas from Europe changed the rest of the world and eventually turned it against us. One had a duty to know about one's own religious tradition and take a pride in it, and people began to get militant about their own religion. It was not something you questioned or criticised or indeed thought about much at all. It's something you fight for. So Judaism begat Zionism, Islam begat Islamism, Hinduism begat militant BJP Hindu nationalism, and even Buddhist monks took to the streets. The most horrific example of this change of religion is the fact that in the recent fighting in Sri Lanka, Buddhist monks came out on the government side against the Tamils. But then, in the Sri Lankan nationalist mythology, the cosmic Buddha gave the whole island of Ceylon to the Sinhalese people as their territory, to be lived in by them alone. So the belief that your God gave you your ancestral homeland to be your land forever has got into even Buddhism, which is amazing. It's worse than that. As during the 20th century, there was an enormous expansion of world population from 1 to 6 billions, technological advances, political upheavals, and cheap mass travel all combined to encourage very large-scale population movements. These movements are transforming every large country, and especially every large Western country, from a nation into an empire. A nation is a more or less ethnically and religiously homogeneous group of people who feel that they're all of one blood and are all interconnected by descent. By contrast, an empire embraces under a single political authority peoples of very diverse ethnic, cultural, religious, and linguistic backgrounds. Thus, the British used to be, and perhaps as late as 1950, still felt they were a nation. But now they feel the country becoming much more like an empire. More than that, we realise that our modern conception of what a religion is commits the people of each major faith to try to build around themselves the entire social and cultural world of their own tradition. And it is indeed entirely right and natural that just as Christians have always wanted to Christianise the whole of British social and cultural life, so today Muslims should want to make Britain into a Muslim country. Our own logic commits us to recognising the perfect legitimacy of their ambition. If Christians want to Christianise the whole of Britain, why shouldn't Muslims feel just as entitled to set out to Islamise the whole of Britain? Why not indeed? Even the Jews, tiny though their numbers now are, can still seek planning permission to create purely Jewish districts in London by running overhead wires around them to create an eruv. A practical contradiction thus arises. Britain has become like an empire, and I for one rather like living in an empire with all its cultural richness and variety. It's as if nowadays everything is everywhere. Almost all the peoples, all the cultures and religions of the whole world are represented today in modern London, a city of 200 languages, just as all the varied voices and activities of mankind can today be accessed in one's own study. But it's not going to be possible for any one religious group to dominate completely and to remake the whole human world in its own image. All of us now have to learn to live as members of one minority group amongst others. All of us now have to acknowledge others and must acknowledge the limited sovereignty of the state to which we owe allegiance. When in the past many competing religious and ethnic groups had to coexist within one empire, the standard method of reducing friction was segregation. The capital city was divided into quarters, and different ethnic groups out in the countryside lived in different villages, an arrangement that survives in many places today. Perhaps the best place to see quarters in the city is still Old Jerusalem, which I suppose many people here will know. As for villages, well, that's to be seen all over the Eastern Mediterranean, and there are villages of folk of different faith traditions and so on. But in dynamic, rapidly changing societies, segregation soon leads to inequality, and inequality leads to sharp political unrest. And my own belief is that our modern experience is showing us that we need to change our understanding of religion. We need to give up the idea that in our own tradition we already have ready-made a complete civilization in miniature, founded on an exclusive and final revelation of truth and demanding of our absolute and exclusive allegiance. The very idea of the completeness and finality of one's own religion is not really compatible with getting used to living in a minority. Still more, do we need to give up the idea that our very identity as persons is given to us by and through our commitment to that idea of religion. And that's what I mean by learning to live without identity. We need to become inwardly globalised. Nowadays, when everything is everywhere, I'd rather lose my separate English identity and be everyone and anyone. 10 years ago, I was asked to write a contribution to a symposium of essays on the dialogue between Judaism and Christianity. In response to that challenge, I wrote a deliberately subversive piece saying that I was unhappy with the whole idea of there being two big things, one called Judaism and the other called Christianity, and each being a kind of finished block, completing itself and not liable to change. Sorry, but no. That whole way of dividing up the religious world and talking about religious differences is now inappropriate. In our society, we don't live in one or another of a whole series of walled-off ghettos. Everything is everywhere, and everything now mingles. None of us can claim privileged access to his own tradition. On the contrary, all your tradition is just as accessible to me as mine is to you. The whole idea of any privileged access to truth is dead. Everything is in the melting pot today, everything mingles, and I'd like to talk about what will emerge from this mingling. Where is it taking us, and what kind of future will there be for religion? Here's what I wrote 10 years ago, and what I still think today. Is it now too late to be talking about Jewish-Christian dialogue? As it is usually understood, the phrase implies cautious, friendly conversations or negotiations between teams of somewhat elderly parties, mostly male, who represent two independent communities of faith. The aim is to find some common ground and to establish amicable relations. In short, to agree to differ, because it is tacitly taken for granted that the two communities propose to remain permanently distinct. We're coming together in order to agree upon how we can most peaceably stay apart. On neither side is there expected to be any compromise whatever, because it's taken for granted that religious allegiance is like allegiance to one's own nation, but even more so. It is both what people call an identity and what people call an absolute. That seems to mean that through it, uniquely, we identify ourselves, finding our place in the world and our task in life, and that therefore its moral claim upon us overrides all other claims. Accordingly, negotiations between representatives of different religious groups are rather like diplomatic negotiations between the representatives of distinct sovereign states. The talks may lead to the establishment of peaceful, friendly, and cooperative relations between the two sovereign parties, but sovereignty itself remains axiomatic and non-negotiable. It's an absolute, a unique identity, almost an eternal essence, something one cannot envisage ever being superseded or becoming obsolete. Its claims are a matter of life and death. For their sake, one must be ready to accept martyrdom, or even nowadays, to get involved with terrorism. This ancient idea of unconditional allegiance to some local group is still found in many forms in our own late modern world. It may be called fundamentalism, tribalism, communalism, ethno-nationalism, and so on. And it creates a rather untidy picture of the human scene. The local god or nation or other object of unconditional allegiance to which people rally may nowadays be almost any threatened language or ethnic group or race or religious group or nation state. And the domains of these various foci of absolute allegiance may very easily overlap and so create acute and painful conflicts in the minds of individuals. Now, I have a number of arguments to put forward in connection with this situation. Their cumulative effect, I shall suggest, is that we should give up the received quasi-political and highly reifying ways of thinking about the synagogue and the church and the dialogue between them. The very notion of a religion has a small, distinct, unchanging, self-identical, closed ideological world, like an idealized, isolated sovereign nation, in which people are unanimous in matters of belief, is dead. Nowadays, we can't even say very clearly who the Jews are, or who might count as their officially accredited and generally recognized representatives. There are too many shades of lapsed membership and partial belief. And the same is true of Christianity and the church. By the way, it occurs to me, relevant to this discussion, you'll know that the synagogue and the church is a standard theme in Christian art, but they're always represented as twin young women who look exactly the same, which is rather interesting. Rather than being pictured artistically as being in sharp contrast with each other, they're two beautiful young women. I'm just thinking of a particular image of them, I think at Bamberg, where there is magnificent sculpture. That suggests that the best Christian artists were already in protest against picturing these things in sharply antagonistic ways. Interesting. At any rate, I argue that the real situation is that if we want to go on thinking of Judaism and Christianity as distinct traditions, each with its own literature, its own body of beliefs, its characteristic style, then we should recognise that they are nowadays fast becoming entities like Platonism, as their embodiment in a distinct community of shared belief becomes ever less clear-cut. They're becoming assimilated. They're turning into relatively enduring and identifiable strands within a historically evolving global cultural tradition. As such, they're no longer strictly tied to one territory or organisation. They're becoming public property, freely accessible to everyone and part of everyone's thinking. By the way, I may mention that the last great Jewish genius, Derrida, wrote extensively about Christianity, and he saw himself as much a part of the Christian tradition as of the Jewish. Our own Dan Cohn-Sherbock, who many people here will know, is another example of the same kind of person. Of course he's a Jewish rabbi, but he writes a great deal about Christianity, and in a sense he knows it as well as he knows his own Judaism. So it is that all the religions are coming to belong to all of us. In this sense, I am myself as Jewish as many Jews, and as much a Buddhist as many Buddhists. Nowadays, we all of us contain multitudes. A great tradition eventually comes to belong to the whole human race. When, not long ago, the site of Aristotle's Lyceum was found in Athens, local politicians declared grandiloquently that the remains bear witness to the continuity of Hellenic civilization, with the implications that your modern Greek politician as the true and legitimate heir and successor of Pericles and Plato. But in practice, people around the world seem to feel able to read Plato and Aristotle for themselves, without needing to be taught about them by modern Greek politicians. And similarly, it has become very noticeable in recent years that the best writing of Christianity no longer comes from Christians, nor even from traditional academic theologians. It comes from post-Christians, and has done so for many years, because modern Christians have come a long way down in the world since the days of their own great tradition, just as modern Greeks and Egyptians are not quite the equal of their remote predecessors. In which case, we should perhaps give up the idea that Christians, Muslims and Jews are three quite distinct communities, rather like nation-states, each with privileged access to its own unchanging core tradition of religious wisdom. Until about the 16th century, something like that was indeed the case. If you wanted to learn about another major tradition, you had to travel and sit at the feet of a learned person from within that tradition. After all, for example, there was no English books about the Jews or about Muslims. Nobody in Britain knew Hebrew. If you want to learn Hebrew, you had to go to a Jew to learn. And similarly, if you want to learn about Islam, you had to travel there. So until the 16th century, there were separate worlds for each religion. But that's not true anymore. Nowadays, abundant printed books, the free worldwide dissemination of information, and the globalization of culture have made everything freely available to everyone. We can now be anything and everything. Most of us, at least, are not confined and don't wish to be confined to a cultural or religious sub-world or ghetto. Judaism and Christianity, like Platonism and Buddhism, are becoming strands in everybody's thinking. That's why, by the way, in my most recent writing, I'm so often saying that post-Christianity is still a form of Christianity. The old idea of an exclusive and unchanging, historically transmitted religious identity, a unique body of truth vested in a special body of people, is rapidly becoming obsolete. Is it not curious that the people who are chosen to represent us in ecumenical and interfaith conversations always turn out to be very cautious and conservative characters who think like lawyers. In a world in which tradition is dying, we seem to feel safest when we are represented by extreme traditionalists. We like to be represented by people who are utterly unrepresentative of us. It's very much as if we want them to go on defending on our behalf positions that we no longer in fact hold ourselves. What then has happened? In the earliest times, or so we're told, religion was monocultural and henotheistic. Each people or ethne had their own language, their own sacred territory, and their own god. Identities were clear-cut to such an extent that if you went to live in another territory amongst other people, those new people became your people and their god your god. See the Book of Ruth. The notion that religion is, or at least ideally should be, strictly ethnic and territorial has survived to this day. People still use terms like Christendom and Islam in a territorial way and speak of lands like France and Italy as Roman Catholic countries. Politicians in those countries don't find it at all easy to acknowledge openly the fact that there may soon be, and perhaps already are, more practicing Muslims than practicing Catholics in the population. In Italy, some years ago, politicians who are not themselves practical Catholics at all nevertheless found they simply could not bring themselves to attend the inauguration of Rome's first major mosque. They were accustomed to think of themselves as post-Catholics in a Catholic country, and somehow they couldn't take in the thought that they might be turning into non-Muslims in a Muslim country. Our thinking, that's a way in which you continue to be a part of your religion even after you've left it behind. They're very strange. Our thinking about true religion and territoriality has become oddly confused. For more than 1.5 millennia, the Jews were in effect the principal and most obvious example of an ancient faith that had lost its own territory and now survived within Christendom, within Islam and elsewhere in encapsulated form. People identified themselves as Jews and were identified in every other way except through their possession of their own holy land. Your Jewishness was conveyed to you in those days through your genealogy, your community membership, your language, scriptures, customs and cultural tradition. But territory, no, that you didn't have. Jews were not actually allowed to own land at all. The Jews were often regarded as a dispersed, homeless, fugitive people living in a state of what then seemed perpetual diaspora, homelessness. The state of being exiled from one's proper sacred territory seemed pitiable. Then came the Restoration, the founding of the State of Israel, and the seemingly wonderful fulfillment of scriptural prophecy. But 50 years later, not all Jews have wished to return to Israel. And visitors to Israel are often astonished to find what a secular society it is and how little regard is paid to the Torah. People eat pork. Can Judaism not survive the fulfillment of its own hopes? Is the recovered possession of one's own holy land now somehow a bad thing for your religion? In countries like the United States, there has for some time been great anxiety that the Jews in diaspora may disappear within another lifetime by complete assimilation into the host culture. But now we find there's a worse danger in the opposite direction. The return to Israel fulfills Judaism and then eclipses it, as all the old precious religious values of Judaism and religion are lost and replaced by militant nationalist politics. Judaism then seems to be caught between Scylla and Charybdis. In America, and in the West generally, it threatens to become just one more strand in the new globalized world historical culture, like Platonism. It has simply become part of the universal syllabus, part of everybody's heritage. and will no longer be or need to be embodied in a distinct, visible human society. At the opposite extreme, Judaism also disappears in Israel. The ancient dream of a mono-ethnic, theocratic state society cannot be realized in the modern world except by turning religious values into political ones. Islam is, of course, nowadays caught in just the same dilemma. And so is Christianity. The idea of a Christian country has, I think, disappeared during our own lifetime. We've had it happen to us. In Western society at large, the Christian tradition has become just one more strand in everybody's cultural heritage. What survives of the church is so drastically reduced that it no longer has any special claim to, and is no longer has any special expertise in, the great tradition now lost. In which case, conversations between officially nominated teams of Jewish and Christian representatives will be mainly exercises in denial. They'll go on being conducted as if old-style, distinct, homogeneous faith communities in which traditional religious values are preserved intact still exist, which is not the case in a world in which all of us alike are mediatized, immersed in the new media culture. And as long as we go on clinging to the memory of our lost, closed worlds, for so long will we fail to discuss the new world that's now taken shape around us. People ancestrally Jewish and people ancestrally Christian are now melting into the new globalized world culture. At our interfaith conversations, we try to reassure ourselves that we really are still different from each other and do still possess our own distinct identities. But the reality is that the process of world cultural assimilation is swallowing us both up. We are becoming more and more alike. All distinct ethnic and religious identities of the old kind that we're so desperately nostalgic for are rapidly vanishing. This very painful example brings out the scale of today's religious crisis. We are right to see the Jews as a light to the nations because certain universal structures of religious thought have been so clearly and even classically exemplified for us all by the Jews for so long. The central Jewish idea was that of a domain unified under a monarch, a transcendent controlling principle and focus of loyalty that has instituted everything and now orders everything. The monarch's power unifies everything and makes it all holy. The holy land, the holy people, the sacred language, the holy books of the law. There's a very clear line between sacred and profane realms, and it's a line that separates insiders from outsiders. And all your various loyalties to your people, to your mother tongue, to your land, to your holy city, to your God, and so on, are all fully integrated. Some such arrangement as this prevailed for most of the time around the world from the beginnings of agricultural civilization until about the year 1500. Christian era, common era. The Hebrew Bible describes with great clarity the rather late establishment of Israel's version of that system and prints it indelibly upon our hearts and minds as a kind of ideal to which we should aspire. This is what we long for. This is how human life should be. This is what it is to have an identity. This is what it is to know where you belong, who your friends are and who your enemies, and how you should live. But it's all fast disappearing now. As I first realized when in 1980 I visited an Inuit community, a primary school, in Baffin Island, and found that the syllabus, the culture, the language, even the pop music being taught to the children was indistinguishable from that in the primary school which my youngest daughter was attending in Cambridge. Amazing. Just the same culture, in the same language, same music, everything, being taught to an Eskimo girl in northern Canada on a remote island and to my child in Cambridge. I had the same astonishment in China, talking with undergraduates in Beijing and finding they're just like undergraduates in Cambridge, with access to the same culture, the same stock of ideas, the same topics of conversation. And even books like Life Life, which you might think very English, with all that those phrases and so on, went straight into Chinese. And there was no difficulty. By the way, again in Denmark, when I quoted in Denmark the life idioms and mentioned get a life, they said, we took that idiom immediately into Danish without even translating it. It was in English in the about 1988. It reached Denmark a few years later. It went around the English-speaking world like a rocket. We're all part of a single world culture that changes almost simultaneously now because communications are simultaneous. In this world, why are we clinging to our identities? It is because they are vanishing so rapidly. Much of religious talk and practice nowadays seems to consist of lamentations over and rather ineffectual attempts to reenact all the things that are now fast melting away. Wouldn't it be better if we were to talk together about what is now coming upon all of us? For is it not the case that our own tradition anticipated the cultural and religious globalization, the reversal of Babel that we now see? The development of a single worldwide communications network, the emergence of a globally dominant language, namely English, and the spread of a single ethic based mainly upon the UN Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, all round the globe, is surely a very significant religious event. The choice of its motto by the BBC a lifetime ago shows that this was once obvious. Nations shall speak peace unto nation. But unfortunately, today we're still absorbed in trying to conserve our separate identities. You've never seen, and I at least have not seen, any piece of recent religious writing that welcomes globalization as Pentecost. Why not? Are we missing something? That's what I wrote in 1997 towards a symposium that wasn't published. And here's my conclusion, to which I still stick: identity is dead, we're better off without it.